She follows direction well, doesn't she? My name is Michael Earle, and I'm a female alcoholic.
Hi, Michael.
And it is such a privilege to be here, especially with all these speakers. I've never seen a state have so many state speakers here. Very seldom, maybe Thursday night, but very seldom. Every speaker is from Georgia except for Jack. And it's given me a sense of pride. It's made me very proud to be from Georgia, and I hadn't reached that point until just this conference. You know, I still had that California mentality where I came from, and I've been here 14 years, but this conference, I just felt this overwhelming, I just want to be a Southern Belle. I don't think that'll ever happen, but it takes a little more than what I have. But anyway, I just can't say enough about all the speakers and how much they mean to me. And I love you, Barbara. And thank you, Tony, for making that first call. And Brendan, Sally, everybody's followed up. The committee's done such a wonderful job. And believe me, I know how hard it is to be on that side. I also know how hard it is to be on this side. You know, speaking isn't always the easiest thing, is it, Dick? I mean, somebody doesn't show up to pick you up at the airport, or, I mean, all kinds of, or they send a newcomer with a car that breaks down. And you have to get out and push it. That's happened to me a couple of times. Can't imagine why I have back problems. But anyway, I'm just happy to be here. I'm not real happy about being the Sunday morning speaker. It's just hard to sit through all these fabulous speakers and be up here. I still always compare myself, and I know I shouldn't do that, but that has not been removed yet. I guess I haven't asked God to remove it, really, truthfully. I've never asked God to remove that. So anyway, Tali, I love Tali, sitting up here with my sponsee and her sponsees and all my girls out in the audience, and Kathy came, and my precious Lynn, who now lives with us. Yeah, she was just in a bad place. She's always been self-supporting through her own contributions, and what happened with the economy, she was in a mortgage broker or a loan officer or something, and she lost everything, and she was just devastated, you know. And I said, just pack up and come move in with us. I thought I was doing for her. The truth is, my daughter is dying, and I took on my 12-year-old granddaughter that's now 13, who wouldn't leave the house because she was afraid she'd find her mom dead, so her education was very lacking. And Lynn just took over. You know, got her into a special school. She rides her butt, and I couldn't. She's turned 13, and she made honor roll this year. So I'm just so proud of her. I don't know if I'm more proud of Lynn or my granddaughter, because my granddaughter's really hard to deal with. Anyway, my husband and I both are passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous. You couldn't be married to me you wouldn't be married to me unless you were passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous. And we work with a lot of newcomers. We always have people living with us. We're going to keep it down to where it is right now because I have a child in the house, and I don't believe in moving in newcomers when you have children in the house. What do they say to their friends about Uncle this, Uncle that? You know, they're not uncles at all. They're just drunks. But and then she wants to run in and show all of her friends my AA room that has 1,000 camels in it. And that's, I had to take her aside and say, honey, let's not bring them in here and have to tell them about, I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous is all over the room. Afraid her friend's parents won't let her come over anymore. But anyway, she's very proud of this program, my granddaughter. And anyway, so we work with newcomers. We work with Fort Gordon, who has a treatment center, and they have, since Iraq, they've gone to three different kinds of, there's RTF, ESAP, ASAP, so we have a lot of soldiers going in and out of the treatment center right now. But before Iraq, they were trying to get rid of the treatment center. The military's gotten rid of most of their treatment centers. The government doesn't want to pay for treatment anymore. Insurance companies don't want to pay for treatment anymore. I mean, if they turned out sober people, we wouldn't need AA, but the truth is, this is something we have to do for the rest of our life. And the only thing that's going to really hold us together is having this fellowship. And I don't even know anybody, unless it's the store clerk, that's not in this fellowship. So I am just surrounded by alcoholics. And I have gotten permission from the treatment center to have these alcoholics at my house on Wednesday night, because we get into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I try to do when it was a little more organized and they were coming in and going out at the same time is get them through my favorite part of the history. And step one, step two, step three, out of the big book, on their knees, saying the third step prayer and showing them how to do a fourth step and trying to hook up somebody to be a sponsor wherever they are going, because I know a lot of people around the United States. And I've had a soldier called Jack. I've had a soldier called Dick. I've had a couple soldiers called Jack and Dick. And it's a gift to just know that there's a contact there that maybe can direct them where they need to go. One of my favorite lines in the big book is the bottom of 14, top of 15. It says, "For if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life..." I'm talking too fast?
Just on the reading. The reading things don't come out. They don't translate easy. So I have to take it in, process it, and turn it back into another English.
I used to be accused of talking really fast in California, and they made me slow down in Georgia. I would give a talk in a half hour that should take an hour, but they kept saying, slow it down. So I got too slow, and the tapers would be very upset because I'd almost go over. Anyway, "For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive those certain trials and low spots ahead." And that sentence tells me two things. First of all, it tells me if I'm not working with others, I fail to grow spiritually. Yeah, I can pray, I can meditate, I can go to church, I can levitate, but when I stay in a state of meditation, I'm no earthly good. And I did that around 2 and 3 years of sobriety, you know, trying to do my 11th step and found that I was getting sicker. And it's because I believe that we are spiritual beings having a human experience. And I am supposed to be here doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And then that sentence also tells me if I'm not working with others, I'm not going to survive those trials and low spots ahead. We are guaranteed trials and low spots. Life still happens on life's terms. People still get sick, old, die, wars still happen. And what's going to get you through these things is getting out of yourself and trying to help another alcoholic. Actually, it says others. It doesn't say other alcoholics until you get to step 12. It says others, and so that means in the program or out of the program. So I've had a lot of surgeries this last 10 years, and I want to have my fist up at God and say, "Don't you see how hard I work in Alcoholics Anonymous? How can you let this happen? I can't do my work if I'm not, you know, able to sit in a chair." And but anyway, it's been a gift. It's been an absolute gift because I had those soldiers coming over every Wednesday night. I feel like I was always planted in the middle of these newcomers, and my sobriety, all of that went real smooth. There was no temptation. I just had those soldiers. And one day I had a back surgery. It was a real serious one. I've had three of them. And the next day was Wednesday, and I'd gone home Tuesday night. Wednesday I woke up and I was just sick as a dog. I mean, I had blood loss and a temperature and these staples all up my back, and I told Ted I didn't think I could meet with the soldiers that night. And all through the day, I kept hearing my sponsor. She used to say, you can be sick in bed as well as you can be sick in a meeting. Sick is sick. You're going to feel like crap, so you might as well feel like crap with your butt planted in a meeting. And, of course, surgery is different, but I still kept hearing that nagging, nagging voice. And I used to say, oh, I know, I'll go plant my butt in a meeting and just spread the flu, you know. But so I decided to meet with the soldiers, and we were on step two. And the foyer's full of soldiers and some outside AAs, and my AA room's full of soldiers. I think we had about 35 people. And the minute the word God came up, this guy who was sitting right next to me, his name was Lee, just jumped up, and he was screaming things at me. And, I mean, I could feel the spit on my face. That's how angry he was. The spit was on. My first thought was, I can't believe I got out of bed for this crap. I wouldn't tell that when I first started telling this story. I made it a little sweeter, but that's the truth. And then I just said, okay, God, help. The other soldiers got him settled down and back in his seat. And out of nowhere, I thought of this man named Lee who wrote me a letter about a spiritual experience he had during one of my AA talks. Had nothing to do with me. It had everything to do with him. And instead of committing suicide or taking that drink, he decided to come to one of the meetings at the conference I was at. And it was called Gulf Shores Jubilee. And on the stage, they had this big, beautiful Mardi Gras sign that said Jubilee. And bottom line is, he wrote me 2 years later. It took him 2 years to write me this letter about the spiritual experience he had. And he said that he didn't listen to my talk at all until I closed. And I always close with how I came to terms with my God in my life today, and that was through tragedy. My daughter was 3 years sober. I was 4 years sober. She was leaving an AA dance. A man came up to her and her girlfriend with a gun, forced them in the car, kidnapped them, knocked the one girl unconscious, and totally, brutally raped my daughter for over 2.5 hours. I hate the word rape. It sounds like it's just about sex, but it's about terror and it's about violence. And the whole process, I can't even say the process is over. I think that's all added to her sickness today. But anyway, so he said when I was sharing about how I came to terms with God, it took, my daughter lost her sobriety. I managed to keep mine. But everything I believed about God went out the window. And I had to seek God at a new level. And I had to seek, and I had to seek, and I had, over a 9-year period, many small spiritual experiences, then a huge one, which I hope I'll have time to close with today. But all I can tell you that I know about God is that God is good, and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God. There's a difference between man's world and God's world, and that kidnap happened in man's world. And Lee wrote me that when I was saying the words, God is good and good is God, this force that he could not explain started to push his chin up, because he looked down at the floor the whole time, not thinking or listening to what I was saying. He was just thinking about himself. And this force started to push his chin up. And by the time his chin came up, I was saying the words, God is good, good is God. And he opened his eyes to look at me. And my body was blocking the whole part of the sign that said Juba. You know, where you sit, you can see things, or your body blocks things. Where he sat, my body was blocking the whole part of the sign that said Juba. And the only part that he could see was his name in big neon lights. Lee. So I'm saying, God is good, good is God. And he looks up and it's Lee. And he said he had this feeling, and he was startled, and it was like God was talking to him. And so 2 years later, he wrote me this letter of how his life had transformed. So I was sharing that story with these soldiers and this man named Lee, who is sitting here all puffed up. And when I got to the part that said God is good and good is God, I'm looking to see, a lot of these places have bushes. We had two bushes on both sides of this couch. Somebody shoved the one bush into the corner where there was a halogen lamp. And this is the honest God truth. The halogen lamp caught on fire and the bush caught on fire. Poof! I've got this fire. My house is on fire. I can't think of his I can't think anything about him saying a burning bush. All I know is my house on fire. I'm freaking out. I'm screaming at the soldiers. They're jumping up trying to get the fire out. They got the fire out. They got the bush out and brought fans in, blew the smoke out. And then we all sat down again. And when my fanny hit that seat, all of a sudden I got it. I did not get it until my fanny hit that seat. And I just remember thinking, oh, my God. Oh, my God. He demanded a burning bush, and God delivered it. And you could feel this energy go around the room to every person in the room till it made full circle and it came back to me. And the whole point of me sharing this story is I could have missed that. I could have used my surgery as an excuse to stay in bed, and I would have missed it. It was not only a spiritual experience for him, it was a spiritual experience for every one of us in that room. And these soldiers were all so transformed, they went back to the treatment center. The treatment was so impressed about the transformation of these soldiers that they started busing them over to our house. We used to send alcoholics in cars and go pick them all up and bring them all over. And, I mean, this was great. Now we don't have to, you know, go get these guys and take them back. But this bus looks like a prison bus. It's a big white bus. That's on, I mean, it looks like the one on the highway these prisoners get off and pick up trash and get back on. That's what the bus looks like. And I live on a little cul-de-sac. And the bus comes all the way down, and it has to circle the cul-de-sac, come all the way up, and it stops in front of my house. So everybody sees this bus. And this has been going on for a lot of years. The bus has been coming for about 7 or 8 years, and not once has a neighbor had the courage to ask me, what goes on in your house on Wednesday night? I think if I thought a prison bus was across the street from my house, I'd go ask, you know, do I need to lock my doors or worry about anything? And the soldiers aren't in uniform, so you just have not a clue that these guys are soldiers. And I am just so happy when I see a soldier that's got a few years of sobriety at a convention that had been to my house that comes up and says, I was at your house every Wednesday night. And I'm going to embarrass Rob. He just commenced from the treatment center on Wednesday, and he was coming back to this area. I told him about this conference, and he's here. Where are you, Rob? Way in the back. Yay. And one of our other soldiers, a female soldier, she came Thursday night, and she got to hear Jules. And it just, you know, it just warms my heart, and Rob needs contact numbers because he got on the train to come here, and he needs numbers of people. He doesn't know who lives near him. I don't know who lives near the fort, but if any of you have any contacts or willing to give rides or whatever, please see him because he is willing to go to any length. He is one of the soldiers right from the start that was willing to go to any lengths. So anyway, what a blessing. When I crawled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous over 30 years ago, God, what happens to time, Tony? What happens to it? It's like, where did the last 15 years go? It just goes by fast. The older you get, the faster it goes. Anyway, I crawled through the doors over 30 years ago, and I had a formal ninth grade education. I didn't know how to work. I lived on welfare. I was reduced to prostitution, and I was a thief. And all of that was before I took that first drink at the age of 25. I always swore I was never going to be an alcoholic like my mother. And when I took that first drink at the age of 25, I immediately went downhill. We got a slow group. How many newcomers do we have here, say, with less than a year of sobriety? Yay. Welcome. Yay. I love the newcomers, but I love the old timers. And a lot of the time when we're saying that prayer for the alcoholic who's still suffering, I hope people keep in mind that a lot of the old timers are suffering. And they need every bit as much attention. So I found that out as I became a little older in the program, and I was a suffering alcoholic. But I am through that period now, thank goodness. I like to welcome the newcomers, and I like newcomers to know that the absolute highest you get in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober. It is not a speaker. It's not a DCM, delegate, trustee. The absolute highest you get in this program is sober. But there's a difference between being sober and being dry. And I was told that this program is not a program for spectators. This is a program of action. And those actions are the 12 steps as laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Bob, one of our co-founders, said if you simmer those 12 steps into two words, those two words would be love and service. And before he said that, he said, I want to emphasize the simplicity of this program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian concepts that are interesting to the scientific mind but have little to do with our actual AA life. I like to talk about Dr. Bob because I come from a line of sponsorship that comes down from Dr. Bob. I'm getting emotional. I'm sorry. I'm getting emotional. A line of sponsorship that comes down from Dr. Bob. And not that this is the way to do the steps. It's just a way. And I believe when you're really ready, when you're ready to go to any lengths, you're going to be directed to exactly what you need. You might need a mean sponsor. I, as a dick, did not need a mean sponsor. I mean, I had all that meanness out there. You know, I needed to come in here and feel like I was worth something, and that's what the people in Alcoholics did for me. Anyway, so the only difference about the way we work the steps is from the early days of the Oxford group and the first drunks getting sober, they had six steps. And at the third step, they did it was called the moral inventory. And with their sponsor, they took the actions of 6, 7, and 8. They went over character defects at great length. They believed you'd drink over them. They said the seven-step prayer. The sponsor helped them make that list of amends to make, when and where. That was all done on the moral inventory. And Bill wanted to stretch those steps into 12, and so he took those actions, gave them numbers, and just threw them into the book. They were in a hurry to get the book written, and so you can find 6, 7, 8, the beginning of 9, all on one page. Nothing is really clarified about step 6. I know a lot of people say that God knows what their defects are, and when he's ready, he'll remove them. That hasn't been the case for me. I was never struck then because God knew of my character defect with food. I had to address it. And, I mean, I had 15 years before I moved to Georgia of being free of food, fat, and diet. I was a size 6, and I stayed a size 6. And as you can see, some of our character defects flare up again. I want to blame it on surgery and steroids and all that has part of it, not being able to exercise. But, you know, I lost my discipline with my food. And so Bill addresses that in the 12 and 12. And that's where I believe the 12 and 12 really enhances the big book. He says that God will not render you white as snow without your cooperation. He says a man that repeatedly works on his other defects of character grows in the image of his creator. And then he addresses the fact that some of our character defects are harder to remove than alcoholism. Alcoholism is not a natural instinct. It's really a slow suicide. But some of our other defects are natural instincts that have gone awry. And Bill said that we might have to just settle for patient improvement. And the big book says if I'm not willing to address something specific, I pray for the willingness. And that's where I'm at right now. I'm just praying for the willingness to get what I had and keep it this time. But it was something that really showed me what would happen if I picked up a drink. And I'm so glad it was food and not alcohol. Anyway, so that's how I take people through the steps. When I listen to a step five, we do 6, 7, and 8. The big book says after step five, go home, take the book down from the shelf. Hopefully it's not on the shelf, or maybe you can put it on the shelf and take it down just so you can do it perfectly. And it says to look over those first five proposals, and I do have them do that, but they don't leave my house. Home can be in the heart. They don't leave my house. They stay in the AA room for that period of time in prayer and just communicating with God. And then I go back in there and we do 6, 7, and 8. And I show them how to do 12-step work. We talk about what are they going to do to live in 10, 11, and 12. And then I push them out there and I say, now you go sponsor somebody. I know our pamphlet recommends a year of sobriety, but if that was so years ago, we wouldn't have Alcoholics Anonymous today. And I know people that did not get sober, real sobriety, until they started working with others. You know, they were around and around and around and finally got them to a place, and I told them, just go find somebody to work with, and they got permanent sobriety. So I really do believe working with others is a selfish act. It's to guarantee immunity from drinking again. And I've seen it work over and over. A little bit about my background. First of all, I'm Irish, German, and Cherokee, and I'm illegitimate. I'm born out of wedlock. Today it's not a big deal, but when I was a little girl growing up, it was, and my childhood is pretty appalling. So in my mom's defense, I want to tell you a little bit about her childhood, because as bad as my childhood was, my mom's was worse. And this program gave me the ability to have a loving relationship with my mom, even though she couldn't quit drinking. I lost my mom, I guess, around 15 years ago. She died of lung cancer. I had the opportunity to practice love and service at home. My sister and I took her home. We had hospice come in, and my mom actually got to die with a little bit of dignity. I had the ability to get in bed with my mom, hold her all night, and just love her unconditionally. And I had to watch her drink on top of morphine up until the day she could no longer swallow. It's probably one of the hardest things I've done. But one thing I learned from this experience is that my whole life growing up, I was so focused on the things I hated about my mom, the things that I didn't want to be like, that I missed all of her wonderful qualities. She had a lot of wonderful qualities, and I really miss her a lot today. But my mom came from an alcoholic background, and when she was 13, her mother was murdered in a drunken brawl. A drunk slit my grandmother's throat. So that left my mom out on the streets at the age of 13 because her father was in a chain gang, which is a prison. And so she's out on the streets trying to take care of herself at the age of 13. She had her first baby when she was 14, which she gave up for adoption, and then she had me. She did everything in her power to keep me. She later met this man who was a wonderful man, got married, had 3 boys, and we all moved to California. That marriage soon ended in divorce, and my stepfather moved back to Colorado. So that left my mom out in California trying to raise 4 little kids. And when we were raised on welfare, we were raised in extreme poverty, always having lights, gas, telephones turned off, being evicted, even having to sleep in cars. And then I had to deal with my mom's alcoholism, I had to deal with her prostitution, and I had to deal with all of her suicide attempts. When I was 12, my mom got pregnant again. It's all the girls are illegitimate and all the boys are legitimate. So anyway, my mom got pregnant again, and this time she sent my 3 younger brothers to live with their real dad in Colorado. Now, my brothers are my very best friends. When you're sleeping in cars and you're always being evicted, you're always moving, you don't have an opportunity to make friends. So my brothers were my friends. So I feel like at the age of 12, I already had all these feelings that I later brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those feelings were of low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to, and just not good enough. And that was a direct result of all that poverty. I forgot to tell you that my mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the psychiatric effort, different times, but we went to the same psychiatrist. Of course, the result was nil. But the good news is that today that psychiatrist is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the religious effort, different times in different congregations, but the result was the same. And believe it or not, today that very same minister that counseled me is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to joke around and say I think we drove these two men to drink. But the truth is, this is the truth, my mom slept with the psychiatrist and I slept with the minister. And that's my only qualification for being the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. So after my brothers left, the psychiatrist pointed out to me that I had these issues of abandonment. I never knew my real dad. My stepdad went away. My three brothers went away. My mom's always trying to kill herself. And because of some other childhood experiences, I would say I'm a fear-based person. I've always been afraid of people, places, and things. And two very important things I learned when I got to this program. First of all, I learned that feelings are not facts. And all those things I used to think about myself were not the truth. And best of all, I learned how to walk through fear. And I learned that every time I walk through fear, I'm actually exercising faith. And this last year I've walked through one of my biggest fears, and it's getting on airplanes. It took me 12 and a half years of sobriety to finally get on an airplane. And I found out I'm not afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. My sponsor told me I'd better be clear on what my fear was when I was asking God to remove it. But I hear things in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not in the big book, and I believe what's in the big book can be taken to the bank, and otherwise it's just our opinion. And everybody has opinions. I have opinions, which I share, but I try to tell you when it's out of the big book. And I used to always hear, excuse me, that you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. This old-timer used to pass out a coin with fear on one side, faith on the other side, and you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And I couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong in my program because I had worked these steps as hard as I could work these steps. I've had many spiritual experiences, but I still had all this overwhelming fear. And I went up to him and I asked him, I said, what am I doing wrong? Why do I still have all this fear? And he said, well, it sounds to me very smug way, like you haven't taken a thorough third step. Today I know I had taken a thorough third step. For me, the third step, a thorough third step is a process. It's not just saying the third step prayer and handing it up to God. It's not words. It's actions. And those actions, for me, was taking the actions of 4 through 9. That's how I do a thorough third step. I went up to one of these old-timers who was really instrumental in my sobriety. We had two brothers named Bill and Frank Honeycutt that just took me under their wing. They were like the father images I never had. And little brain fart. See how she does that? Anyway, fear and faith. That's right. Thank you, Jack. So anyway, I went up to one of these old timers who was instrumental in my sobriety, and I was crying on his shoulder. I was actually telling on this other old timer. And he said, I haven't taken a thorough third step because I still have all this fear. And Bill said, Michael, nowhere in the big book does it say you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And he took me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He pointed out a page to me, and it's page 68, under the fear inventory. And that sentence says, all men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. And then he pointed out to me that you don't need courage unless you're afraid. Duh. And then we went down to the very bottom of that paragraph, and it gives you that little fear prayer. God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And I'm always directed, or you can put what the fear is in that place. I'm always directed to work with another person, to help another person, in the program or out of the program. That's how I started getting on airplanes. I just remember my very first time I had to fly for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was just dropped at LAX. Sat in a chair, had a full-on panic attack, knew I was not getting on that plane, and I wasn't going to keep this commitment. And my legs shook so bad, I just fell back into a chair, and when I fell back, I started crying. And when I started crying, there was some kind of a release, and I had this inner voice that talks to me quite a bit. Not so much anymore, because I'm talking to myself a lot. But the inner voice said, Michael, why don't you get out of yourself and try and help somebody? And I'm looking around the airport, and I'm going, this isn't an AA meeting. Who do I help? And I noticed some little old ladies, much like myself today, struggling to get their bags up this escalator to where the planes are. And so I ran over there, and I started helping. I would go to the airport early every time, and I'd help people with their bags up the escalator. Sometimes they didn't know I was trying to be helpful. I think one woman hit me with her purse. But that really did help me. And when we're in a lot of turbulence and you can't jump up on the plane and say, let me help somebody, let me help somebody. I always carry pen and paper with me, and I start writing out the third step prayer, and I put somebody else in it. Like God, I offer Barbara to thee to build with her and do with her as thou wilt. So I write the whole third step prayer, putting somebody else's name in it, and by the time we land, I have pages and pages and pages of the third step prayer. So now I know it by heart, and as you can see, we've landed safely every time. That last sentence in that paragraph says, at once we commence to outgrow fear. It does not say, at once we outgrow fear. It says, we commence to outgrow fear. So here I am, 30 years sober, and I'm still commencing. But that's okay. That's covered in the big book, too, under steps 10 and 11. In step 10, it says that we're to continue watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. It says it's not an overnight matter, that it should continue for a lifetime. Whew. And then in step 11, it has this on retiring at night. And it asks seven questions. And even though it is under the 11th step, it's the way I do my 10th step. And I do my 10th step in writing because I did my 4th step in writing. And I answer those seven questions. The first question says, and it says it's a constructive view, not destructive. The first question says, were you selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid? It says, do you owe an apology? Have you kept something to yourself that you should share with another person? One of those questions that has been a beneficial tool for me is the question that says, what could you have done better? I can't change my behavior unless I know what I can change it to, what it looks like. So writing out what I could have done better really helped me make changes in my life. And then it tells you to look for the good things. Were you kind and loving toward all? Were you packing into the mainstream of life? Every one of you who are sitting at this convention are packing into the mainstream of life. Every one of you that sits in a meeting and goes to your home group and goes to your business meetings and has these little jobs is packing into the mainstream of life. And we need to give ourselves credit for that. If you're an alcoholic of my type, I would use the 10th step to beat myself up with, and I don't do that today. And I do my formal prayer and meditation in the morning because it says on awakening, and I want to do it right. So I do it on awakening, but I do pray throughout the day. I need to pray pray throughout the day. So anyway, I'm 13 years old now, and my mom does have this baby. And this little baby is sleeping in a dresser drawer. My mom's alcoholism takes her out of the home. Day and night, she's never home. I have full responsibility of this baby. I had to learn how to be a mother, and I didn't even know how to be a kid. And I had to eventually potty train her, bottle break her. I'm failing in school because I can't get to school because of this responsibility. After I did my inventory, I found out the truth was I hated school anyway. When I went to school, I was either an object of pity around my peers, or I was teased about the way I dressed and teased about my hair. So specifically to get out of my home life, I got married at the age of 15. And the man I married, you can rack up a lot of marriages when you get married at the age of 15. Oh, no. Oh, The man I married was 18. He lived in the neighborhood. He came from a similar background. And I have such a colorful past, I like to brag about this. I want everyone in this room to know, when I got married at the age of 15, I was not pregnant. At the age of 15, I had high morals and high values, and much like Dick, it was from two of my favorite TV shows that I used to watch when I was around the TV, and it was Father Knows Best and Donna Reed. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with those programs, except for Dick, but they are family. You know, it's about families and how they should act together, and they just, they just gave me high morals and high values. And my whole life growing up, all I knew is I didn't want to be an alcoholic like my mom, and I didn't want a prostitute like my mom. So when I got married at the age of 15, I had this wild idea that I missed Donna Reed, marrying Mr. Father Knows Best. And unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. I believe the man I married was an alcoholic. His name was Johnny Walker. I should have had a clue, but I didn't even know about that stuff. Anyway, so I want to share a story with you about that sister of mine, the one that slept in the dresser drawer, because when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to blame my alcoholism on my mom's alcoholism, and I blamed the way I turned out on the way I was raised. And after I got sober in this program, I took a good look at that sister of mine, because she came from the very same background. In fact, I would say her childhood was worse than mine because my mom's disease had progressed. And my sister was literally forced to move out of the house at the age of 16. So she quit school and she moved out. But what she did is she took that high school equivalency test. And she had to take it 3 times until she finally passed it. With this test under her belt, under a special youth program, she went to work for the city of Long Beach. At the age of 26, she retired from the city of Long Beach. She took her 10 years retirement pay, and she bought her own business. She later married the head traffic engineer for the city of Long Beach. And at the age of 30, my sister was awarded Woman Entrepreneur of the Year. Even today, sometimes I still don't get it, you know. Same mom, same background, but different reactions. And the difference is my sister is not an alcoholic. My sister is not bodily and mentally different from her fellows. My sister reacts to life situations differently than I do. So today I get to accept responsibility. I can no longer blame all those people, places, and things. Yes, I am an alcoholic, and I do have a disease. But today I have a solution, and for me, part of my solution is being accountable for my actions, my past actions and my present actions. So at the age of 15, I got married. At the age of 17, I did have a baby. At the age of 18, I had to get out of this marriage because this man took me through a whole new phase of alcoholism I never experienced with my mom, and it's called physical abuse. And he never abused me unless he was drinking, but he abused me to the point of cutting me up with a knife, and I had to have surgery to repair the damage. So I got out of that marriage at the age of 18, and I feel like that's when I started on the road of being everything I swore I'd never be, doing everything I swore I'd never do. Hadn't even taken a drink of alcohol yet. I always intuitively knew when I was growing up, if I took a drink, I'd be an alcoholic. But it started out with me being a single mother living on welfare. My whole life growing up, I swore when I grew up I was not going to live like that. And there I was. Now, on page 23 in the big book, it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So we're talking about the main problem being the mental obsession and not the physical allergy. And I know for me, I practiced my disease of alcoholism way before I ever took that first drink, because I've always had the mental obsession part of this disease. And I practiced my disease in the form of compulsive overeating. I would shove food in my mouth instead of alcohol. And then I discovered that wonderful world of diet pills. And that's back in the days when doctors gave pure amphetamines. I mean, pure methadrine. So nothing like they have out today. It was pure. And so anyway, I went on this diet for 16 years. When I finally took that drink of alcohol at the age of 25, I immediately had the physical allergy. From that very first drink, I had the phenomena of craving. From that very first drink, I had a personality change. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you read about that in the Big Book. The Big Book refers to that as a real alcoholic. And I personally am so physically allergic to alcohol, when I drink alcohol, I break out in a rash, welts, and hives all over my body. I was always too drunk to have a clue that that wasn't normal. But if I'd had a clue, it wouldn't have made a difference. But from that very first drink, I drank morning, noon, and night, and I did not draw a sober breath from the age of 25 to the age of 31, and that is not an exaggeration. I had a huge spiritual experience way before I ever got to this program, and it was equivalent to the one that Bill had in Bill's story. As a result of this spiritual experience, I sought out a specific church, and I counseled with the minister, and I told him all about my spiritual experience. And he told me that if I got really active in this church, and I read all these inspirational books, I did all this positive thinking and all these affirmations, that I could be everything that I ever wanted to be. After I got to this program, I heard a speaker at the podium say, if you're alcoholic, you cannot think your way into right actions. He said, if you're alcoholic, you have to act your way into right thinking. And I'm absolute proof of that because I got really active in that church. I became the secretary of the church. And as secretary, it was my job to handle the money. And I just need to tell you, the only thing that resulted from my being in that church is I had a torrid affair with this minister that absolutely infuriated his wife. And the congregation wasn't very excited about it either. Well, they were excited, but it wasn't the right kind of excited. But the one thing I'm going to share with you now is the one thing I thought I'd take to the grave with me. As secretary of that church, when I was handling the money, I stole part of that money. At that point in my life, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt my only hope was God because I just had a spiritual experience. I turned to God for help. And I ended up seducing his minister and ripping off his church. So I truly know the feeling of hopelessness that they talk about in the Big Book. And I'm going to share two stories with you while I'm on the subject of the minister, because the first one I think's funny. I might start laughing before I even get to it. It's the first time I was ever able to laugh at any part of my alcoholism. I always heard that laughter was healing when I came in these rooms. And at first, I was totally incapable of laughing. And I would always hide out in the back of the room. I have a friend named Teddy, and she calls the back of the room the half-measure section or the denial section. I noticed a bunch of people setting chairs up way back there against the door when we have all these chairs up in the front. I make no judgment, though. I judge no one because that's where I was. And the reason why I hung out back there wasn't because I was in denial or half measures. I hung out back there because I couldn't read very well. I was terrified that they would ask me to read something. And I literally could not say the word anonymity for over 6 months. So I'd hide out in the back of the room. And we have very funny speakers in California, very theatrical, and they'd get up at the podium and share their story, and it was hysterical. Everybody would laugh. But I was incapable of laughing, absolutely incapable of laughing. And after I had about 2 years of sobriety under my belt, I found myself in the back of the room laughing too. And it was a big, huge belly laugh. But right after I had this laughter, I found myself thinking, well, that might be funny for you. But there's nothing in my background I could ever laugh at. And then about, God, I lose track of time, 18, 20 years ago, it was my second time to give an AA talk. I never shared my story till I was 11 years sober. I could not get at the podium and read how it works at the age of 4 years of sobriety. I just couldn't do it. It was a huge fear for me. So it was my second time to give an AA talk, and my daughter wanted to come hear me. She was trying to get sober one more time, and she brought some of her program girlfriends over. We sat down, we had coffee, and she proceeded to tell these girls my drunkalog. And for some reason, it was a little funnier coming out of her mouth than out of my head. And of course, she's telling these girls about the minister. And she's telling these girls that I'm dragging her off to church every day, and she's learning things like the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule. I'm all, constantly preaching all this religious stuff to her. She comes home from school at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She opens the bedroom door, and there, naked, in bed with her mom, was the married minister of the church. Now, when she first said this, I just felt all this shame and embarrassment and guilt and every emotion you could feel, and except good. I did not feel any good emotions. And I looked at my daughter in the most sympathetic way. I said, God, honey, that had to be a terrible shock. I just never thought about how some of these things look through the eyes of a 9-year-old. That had to be a terrible shock. And she just looked at me and she said, Mom, I don't know what shocked me the most, seeing that minister naked or seeing his artificial leg on the floor. It was a big leg. I don't know how I forgot it. I totally forgot about it until she brought it up. But in ways that were important, he was not disabled. They're quick on that one. Oh, I'm getting a hot flash up here. So the minister of this church was first on my list of amends to make. I found for me the most important step besides step 12 is step 9. Step 9 is the step that truly freed me from the bondage of my past. And in the big book, it's not a coincidence that those promises come after step 9. It says before you're halfway through, you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. You won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, and so on and so on. And I did not have to wait to get halfway through step 9, thank goodness, because it took me 12 years. That happened to me with my very first amends, and that was going back to that church and telling the minister that I used to steal from the church funds. And he told me he knew that. Then I had to tell him I used to steal out of his wallet when he was in the shower. He told me he did not know that. So I made restitution to him, and I had to set up a payment schedule to pay back the church. And I still send money. I still send money today, even though I'm way past due, but I just feel a lot of gratitude for this part that the church played in my sobriety. Anyway, at that time that I got to the minister to make my amends, he shared with me he knew exactly what I was doing. By the time I got to him, he had 2 years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When he lost his leg, he was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he actually died on the operating table. He had one of those near-death experiences, which for him was his spiritual experience. And that's what led him into ministerial school and becoming a minister. And even he could not get sober in church. And I'm not putting down churches, because I know people who do get sober in church. But I'm not putting down churches. I'm not putting down the psychiatric effort, because the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous makes it real clear that this program owes a lot to both of these institutions. And in the Big Book, it says, if you need professional help, do not hesitate to seek it. But for me, it was all about that miracle that happens when one drunk reaches out to another drunk. So I'm kicked out of this church, and I'm living in an apartment I'm being evicted from. Lights, gas, and had been turned off for a few months, but I still had a telephone. It was a working priority. I got this call at 11 o'clock at night, and I could not believe the man on the other end of this phone. It was my real dad, and he wanted to make amends for not being in my life. He wanted to get to know me, and he wanted to get to know my daughter. So he offered me an opportunity to move to Colorado to get to know his whole family, and I did not want to go. I didn't have any desire to get to know him, but mostly I didn't want to move to the snow. But I didn't have anywhere to go except for out on the streets. And I think deep down inside I had this little hope, if I made this geographic, maybe I could change. So I made that move to Colorado. I lived there for 3 months. And that 3-month period, this man and his family could not wait to kick me out of the state of Colorado. In that 3-month period, I ended up having affairs with the bus drivers on the way over there, getting pregnant, having an abortion, falling down the stairs and breaking my leg, ripping off his booze closet, ripping off his medicine cabinet, and ripping off his money. So they literally kicked me out of the state of Colorado. I'm going to tell you how I broke that leg. Obviously, I was drunk. The liquor stores closed at 12, and I had to make my final liquor run. And I didn't have a car, so it was on foot. And we'd had ice storms, and it was snowing. And I'm walking down the stairs because I'm in a second-floor apartment. I'm walking down the stairs, and I'm hanging on to the railing with my right hand, and my daughter's on the left side of me trying to hold me up. And all of a sudden, another second-floor apartment that was directly in front of me opened. And out of that apartment walked a priest. I don't know what he was doing there, but he had the collar, the robe, everything. He's definitely a man of God. And I am very angry at God. I'm angry at God because I seduced his minister and ripped off his church. So now I'm mad at God. And I looked up at that priest. I let go of the railing with my right hand. I flipped up my middle finger and I screamed, "F you, God." And I immediately fell down the stairs and broke my leg. My daughter told me that is the day she started believing in and punishing God. Today, we both know it had nothing to do with God. I fell because I was drunk. But my real dad was second on my list of amends to make when I started making my amends. And I wrote this man a letter, and I told him that I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to make restitution for my behavior up there. I sent him a check trying to set up a payment schedule. Basically, what he and the family did is they sent me the check back with a little note that said they didn't want my money, and they never wanted to hear from me again. I was working with a sponsor, so of course I stayed sober, but I really wanted to make these amends. I just really wanted to make it right. So with her encouragement, on every Father's Day and on every birthday, I would send him an appropriate card. I would tell him I was still sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still wanted to make restitution. I did this for 6 or 7 years, and I never got a reply back. Finally, in 1985 or 1986, I just sent off a card, and within a few days, this envelope came back with his return address on it, and I was so excited. I was just so excited to get a reply, and I ripped open the envelope, and the only thing that was in it was a picture of his tombstone in the obituary of the newspaper. He had just died, and that was the family's way of telling me not to bother trying anymore. And there are no words to express the kind of pain I felt. You would have thought I knew him my whole life, and I didn't. But I took it real, real hard. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out to me I don't make amends for approval. The Big Book tells me I don't make amends to be forgiven. I make amends to clean up my side of the street. I make amends to stay sober. So all I can tell you is that the actions I took worked. Because not once, not even once, was I ever tempted to drink over this rejection. I'm just sorry he did not get to know the person I am today, because I know he would have been proud. Kicked out of a church, kicked out of a state, living in back in Long Beach, California. Across the street from a junior high, which was gang-related school. There's gangs in it. And so my daughter's now 14 years old. She's running with a very dangerous gang. I'm doing awful, humiliating things to my daughter, but I was not only embarrassing my daughter, I was embarrassing this entire gang. live in an apartment, being evicted from lights, gas, and telephone, all turned off for a long time. And I kept my drapes closed because the landlord was trying to evict me, and I didn't want him to know I was home to give me the eviction notice. And so with these heavy drapes closed, no electricity, my apartment's dark. It is so dark that now I'm seeing evil spirits. Unless you've seen these, I thought it was the scotch, but so I switched from scotch to wine. But anyway, I was seeing these evil spirits, and these evil spirits would do things like follow me around the house. And I would do things like crawl out of the house on my hands and knees, butt naked across the street to the school ground, and warn my daughter and her gang friends not to come home. The house was possessed with evil spirits. And this is the kind of stuff I did that makes me wish to God I was a blackout drinker. But I'm not a blackout drinker. I get to remember. One day my daughter and I were having, the neighbors were always hiding my daughter out and feeding her and just protecting her from me. And one day myself and my daughter were at the neighbor's house. She was feeding both of us. And on her counter, she had a bottle of 100-proof vodka. And something happened outside, like an accident or something, and my neighbor and my daughter went to check it out, and I just lagged behind because I wanted to just drink some of that vodka down real fast and not get caught, because I was always promising my daughter I wouldn't drink. And I just grabbed that bottle. I don't know how much I drank or how fast I drank it, but I do know it was enough to stop my respiratory system. I stopped breathing. And I don't remember the paramedics. I don't remember being rushed to the hospital or resuscitated. By the time I had any memory, I woke up and both my hands were strapped down to a hospital bed, and a nurse had just slapped me in the face because I was screaming obscenities and I think maybe spitting at her. And so she slapped me in the face. But this experience did get my attention. This time I almost died under the influence of alcohol. And it scared me. I did not want to die out there. I didn't want to do to my daughter what I had gone through with my mom. All the drama, all the chaos, all the ambulance, all the police. I just didn't want to do that to her. So I finally started listening to her. Because she would tell me on a daily basis, she would say, "Mom, it's the alcohol. And if you wouldn't drink, you wouldn't do those things." She said, "Just smoke pot." So this is my only experience smoking pot, but I'm trying really hard not to drink that day. So I smoked this pot with my daughter and her gang friends. And afterwards, we're walking down the street, and I have on these tight, tight jeans, and I have both my hands stuffed down in my pockets. And I don't know if I tripped over a crack or my own foot, but I tripped, and I started to go down. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been on pot, but to me, it was different. First of all, I had the sensation that the cement was coming up at my face. I felt like I was in slow motion. And you have to picture this, a grown woman. No matter what I did, and I tried really hard as I was going down, I tried to get my hands out of my pockets. And so I couldn't get my hands out of my pockets, and there I am, down. And you have to just picture me, face smashed in the cement, hands still sticking out of my pockets. And all the gang members are laughing hysterically. They were absolutely hysterical. And as I laid there, I could hear their laughter. I wasn't laughing, but I could hear their laughter. And as I heard their laughter, I had that moment of clarity. I knew right then and there, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that pot was not the answer. And I went right back to my drinking. I drank at the same pace for a while longer, but what finally happened for me, I reached a point you read about in the big book, and it's talking about facing those hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I woke up on the front room floor one more morning, naked, Doritos all over my body, feeling those feelings, and I just couldn't do it another day. I just got on my knees. You know, I really believe I took the first three steps at that moment. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. My life had never been it's never been manageable. Alcohol was the solution. I already believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just didn't think he would because of what I'd done to the church. And this was my way of turning my will and my life over to the care of God, as I just got on my knees and I said, "God, please, I don't care how you do it, but please just get me sober." And I managed to get to a telephone. I called a prayer line that was affiliated with the church I'd been in, and I asked them to pray for me, because I thought in my mind, if God wouldn't listen to my prayers because of what I'd done to the church, maybe he would listen to their prayers because they were good people. And they prayed for me for 30 days, and within 30 days, I was sober. And it's a series of God coincidences that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the one place I would not have come, because my mom was in and out of AA, and she proved it didn't work. And she ran around with some sleazy guys. There's also sleazy women. I mean, there's just people that come in this the program. They don't care about the steps, the tradition, your anonymity. They don't care about anything. And those are the kind of people that my mom ran around with. And I was 12 and 13, and a couple of these men made very serious passes at me. And that's what I thought about the men in Alcoholics Anonymous. So this was not an option. So thank God I told God I didn't care how he did it. And it was just a God coincidence how I ended up at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so sick and starting to go into DTs, and two old-timers outside told me not to go in, to wait right here. One was watching over me, and the other one ran across the street to a liquor store, and he bought two beers. He brought them back, and he made me drink those two beers. I thought, wow, this AA is not too bad after all. And it did just what it needed to do. It just calmed me down enough to hear a message at the meeting. And I heard a girl just share my story about not drinking until later on in life and practicing her disease of alcoholism way before she ever took that first drink. But the one thing she said, and this is the reason why I stayed, she said her whole life growing up, kids wanted to be doctors and other kids wanted to be lawyers, but all she ever wanted to do when she grew up was just not to be an alcoholic like her mom. And when she said that, I just started to cry, and I just, for the first time in my life, felt like I belonged. And that was November 10th, 1979. That's the last drink I ever had, was those two beers before I went into the meeting. I don't celebrate my birthday until 3 months later because of that 10th tradition. We have no opinion on outside issues. Well, I mean, methadrine, amphetamines, that's an outside issue. So I continued doing speed. And when you're doing speed, you can do a really fast inventory. I did a really fast inventory. But doing the inventory process, it was revealed to me that I was not sober if I was abusing this medication. So I gave that up January 23rd, 1980, and that's when I celebrate my AA birthday. It took me 10 years to change my date, though. And I think that was necessary, because if I had changed it right then, I probably would have had a drink. That 3 months was so important for me to hold on to. I would have probably had a drink saying, well, F it, I might as well have one good last drunk. And I might not have made it back. So that was necessary for me. And 10 years later, I changed my sobriety date. Boy, that was hard to do. It took you out of the 70s into the 80s. It was like 10 years rather than 3 months. But talk about ego, gosh. Anyway, I did all the things you're supposed to do, got a sponsor. I'm 6 months sober. I'm on my ninth step. My sponsor told me I had to get a job and be fully self-supporting through my own contributions. I don't know how to work. I went out there and I got that first job, a real job. And that's where I learned how to work. I learned things like how to get there every day, how to get there on time, how to not leave early, how to only take a 30-minute lunch break. I did not know how to do those things. I learned them here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked that job full-time for 8 years. I stayed on another 2 years part-time after I took another full-time position, so I was there for a total of 10 years. And when I left that job, I'd worked myself up to assistant administrator. That first eight-year period, I went back to high school. I could not pass a GED, and they didn't have courses for it, so I had to go back to high school. I graduated from high school in 1985. I was 36 years old. I graduated with a cap and a gown. And 450 18-year-olds. They were the kids that were incorrigible, so they were forced to go to night school because they weren't allowed in day school, but I fit right in with them. What I did for the next 6 years is I went to work for a musical theater industry, and it's equity. Equity means union, which means they dealt with big, major stars. I started out at the very bottom in the accounting department. I went back to school. And within a period of time, I worked myself up to business manager of this multimillion-dollar corporation. And as business manager, I dealt with millions and millions of dollars. This is the honest-to-God truth. When I got to this program, I didn't have a clue how many zeros were in $1 million. I have participated in union negotiations. I've been invited into some of the homes of the most famous people you see, even today, on stage, screen, and TV. And even today, I'll see a picture, especially when I left the theater. They made this great big thing for me. It had all the pictures of all the plays I'd been involved with, all the musicals. And I'll see myself in a picture with a very famous person. And I still get overwhelmed, and I still think, how did I ever get from the gutters of Long Beach to being invited into some of these places? And how that happened is I worked the last part of that 12th step. And I applied these principles in all my affairs. If I have time, one last story. How much time do I have? I have time?
Okay.
Okay. It's how I came to terms with the God I have in my life today. I told you that my daughter was kidnapped at the age of 18, and what a brutal experience that was, and it took her 2 years to leave the house. She had nightmares all the time. It was just a brutal experience. Everything I knew about God went out the window, and seeking God at a different level. But my daughter and I felt betrayed by God. How could God let something like this happen to us? We were both sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. How could God let something like this happen to us? Because this is a spiritual program. And we were working these steps as hard as we could. But the hardest thing for me to deal with was the sentence in the big book. And in the fourth edition, it's page 440. In the third edition, it's 449. In the third edition, it's 417. And that sentence says absolutely nothing, and God's world happens by mistake. The rest of that paragraph talks about acceptance, and I like the part on acceptance, but that one sentence, I mean, I'm an alcoholic. Clancy says alcoholism is a disease of perception. I still have that disease of perception because I perceive that to mean that if nothing in God's world happens by mistake, then that had to be an act of God. It had to be an act of God. I wanted to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to leave God because I didn't want any part of a God that could operate like that. And thank God for Bill Honeycutt. He just took me by the hand, and he said, Michael, God is good, and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God. He said, man has free will. That man was acting on his free will, and your daughter was just a victim. He said, if man didn't have free will, we wouldn't all be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd all be perfect people. And when he said that, I had a huge spiritual release. And I knew he was telling me the truth. And I was able to come to terms with my God again. But I still had so much trouble with that sentence. In the big book, somebody could share about something wonderful, say that sentence, and I'd feel absolute rage. And I sponsor a lot of women in this program who have tragic backgrounds. And one of these women made the mistake of telling me that her tragedy must be God's will because in the big book it says absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. I went off on her like a crazy woman and started screaming at her that that wasn't written by the first 100 alcoholics. That's not in the first 164 pages of the big book. I took the big book. I slammed it down. I said it's not even in the first two editions of this book. And I made this woman cry. And as I saw her crying, I mean, I just felt terrible. And it was clear to me that I have a resentment about something in the big book. And this resentment's not only hurting me, now it's hurting other people. So I came to a place of really being willing to give it up, and I prayed for a very long time for God to help me with that sentence. And I was in a meeting with my sponsor, Polly, just a little meeting. She was sharing about that tape out by Clancy, Alcoholism, Disease of Perception. And when she said those words, I had the biggest spiritual encounter I have ever had. I couldn't hear another word Polly said. I couldn't see anything in the room. It was like a white fog. And I had this inner voice talk to me loud and clear, and it wasn't through the ears. And it said, Michael, you know what happens in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is part of God's world. What happens when you're working those 12 steps is part of God's world. The progression of all good is part of God's world. What happened in that car was part of man's world. So I came to the place of being able to separate man's world from God's world, and I came to a place of being able to come to terms with that sentence. 2 weeks after I had that spiritual experience, through, you know, those God coincidences, God shots, whatever you call them, I found myself sitting down having dinner with Dr. Paul, who wrote that sentence in the big book. And I was at such peace, I did not have to go off on him and tell him exactly what I thought about it. Because I knew it didn't matter what he meant when he wrote it. What mattered was how he perceived it. Sometimes I have to work on my perception so that perception can work in my life. And that might not work for you, and that's okay, because I truly believe that God works for each one of us at our own level of understanding. I once heard, if you take one step towards God, God takes 10 steps towards you. And in this lifetime, as we know it, we will never reach God's level of understanding. But once we're on a spiritual path, God does not want to lose one of us. So he comes to each one of us. He works for each one of us at our individual level of understanding. That's why what works for you might not work for me. What works for me might not work for you. But the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is whatever you believe, it will work within the 12 steps. Well, I'm so thankful that I paid attention to something I read in the 12 and 12. It said restraint of pen and tongue. Because I cannot tell you how many times I sat down to write Dr. Paul a hate letter. I didn't know it was a hate letter. I just wanted to get him information about that sentence. But it would have been a hate letter. I never sent it off. I'm thankful for that because Paul became my spiritual advisor. He used to get lots of letters about that sentence, lots of phone calls about that sentence. All people who have had tragedies. And what he did is he would just give him my phone number. Anyway, I want to thank you for allowing me to be here. I know today I've been catapulted into what Bill calls that fourth dimension of existence. No matter what's going on in my life, you know, the good and the bad, I know at any time I can sit down and think about that fourth dimension. Bill talks about it on 25. It's rocketed in that fourth dimension. But my favorite page is page 8 because he gives you a description of what that fourth dimension is like. And I can tell you, any given time, I can sit down and tell you, I know those feelings of happiness, those feelings of peace, but best of all, absolutely best of all, today I know that feeling of usefulness. Thank you.